This is Wyman McGinty, May 9th, 1997. Authentic Movement. Tape 1 of 2.
Wait, is this it?
Oh, that's a good idea.
Is that okay?
Okay. I feel like I'm on Oprah or something.
I want to speak to you tonight about the integration of authentic movement, which is a form of active imagination and analytic practice. And this paper will be published this coming year in JAP, the Journal of Analytical Psychology from London. So it is somewhat of an integration of Jungian and object relations and active imagination theory woven together with a lot of clinical examples.
Do we need to do something different for voice? Is it loud enough? Okay.
Exploring the relationship between psyche and soma has been part of depth psychology since Freud, who believed that consciousness originated in the body, and he saw the body image as the nucleus of the ego. Jung and Freud both looked at the body as a way of analyzing unconscious material and a way of understanding bodily symptoms. Is it still true?
So both Freud and Jung tried to look at underlying physical symptoms and what was causing the symptoms. And a couple of times in Jung's writing, he talks about working with acutely psychotic patients and mimicking their movement, and the psychotic patient responding, "Oh, you know what I'm talking about," and going on to describe their inner experience. And there's also a mention of Tony Wolf using active imagination and movement, I think in the 20s, with one of her women patients who was unable to express verbally what was going on, and Tony encouraged her to just try to close your eyes and let yourself move that experience. And that was a breakthrough experience for that woman, and what was bubbling up in the unconscious was then able to go forward. More recently in analytic writing, particularly in the psychoanalytic circle, people have started to talk about unmentalized experience, meaning what is going on when we have experiences that are known to the unconscious but not yet known to the ego. And we will focus on some of those examples. Yeah.
Could you just repeat
that last 10 words you said? The idea of what is going on and what is being communicated from our patients at a somatic level, which cannot yet be communicated verbally because it can't be thought about. So it's too dangerous to the ego, so we keep it in the body. Also, people have begun to write more in terms of the countertransference, what is going on in the somatic countertransference, meaning what happens to us when we're sitting in the office with our patients and we start feeling hungry or tired or aroused or sleepy, fogged over, that's usually a communication from the patient's unconscious that we're picking up at a body level. And how can we be more clear about what we're experiencing and what's going on with our patients? And using movement, I've been working with a lot of analysts and trainees and therapists in LA, as using movement as a tool to train therapists to be more aware of their own somatic experience so that they can in turn be more aware of what's going on with their patients, even though the patient may not be doing actual movement. Okay, I'd like to describe authentic movement as a form of active imagination and just give you some reasons why I think it's important in analytic practice, and then we'll talk about each of those more specifically. First, as a form of active imagination, it encourages both the analyst and the patient to use the body as a primary means of relating to unconscious material. Now, as analysts, we may use our countertransference responses, as I said a moment ago, to help us understand what's going on. But authentic movement is more of a direct way that a person can begin to amplify their own unconscious material at a somatic level. Secondly, it offers a way of penetrating primitive defense structures. For example, when people have to split image and affect. So the person is flooded with an affect, but there's no image to contain that. Or the patient is very much in their head with all these images, but disconnected from the underlying affective experience. And one of our tasks as analysts is to begin to understand at a body level how these links were broken and usually distorted in the process of creating defensive structures. Focusing on the body seems to allow affects to emerge as well as somatic memory, so the patient has the experience of beginning to link up their internal world themselves. So it's very empowering in that way. When the defense mechanisms are relaxed, we have the sense of observing the original wound and the creation of the defenses which crystallized around that wound. And I'll give you some very specific case examples. Thirdly, authentic movement appears to support individuals in relinking image with affect, in that the individual literally re-experiences the somatic aspect of symbol making. In the process of focusing inward on one's bodily felt experience, images, somatic memory, and the accompanying feelings which arise can then be explored as a communication from the patient's unconscious. And what was previously conserved on a somatic level as unmentalized experience is now available for analysis. It can be thought about, and it can eventually be integrated. Fourth, authentic movement, because the analyst isn't speaking, but sitting quietly, allows the analyst to act as a silent and containing witness. And held by such witnessing, the seemingly disparate pieces can begin to be linked together in the patient's psyche soma. And usually what you see is material that's been repressed will surface when attention is given to the body in this quiet way. And I believe it's the patient's growing ability to bear this previously unintegrated affect which leads to the development and consolidation of the ego. Witnessing also, if you think about Winnicott's work on mirroring, has a direct therapeutic effect in that the patient feels very seen at a core bodily level. You're really seeing me. I don't have to explain it to you. Of course you want the person to be able to talk about it at some point, but initially that's not the goal. It's to make a safe space to just have the experience. And finally, I think it's very important for therapists to develop an awareness of the body psyche, particularly the infant psyche. And we can't do that unless we have an awareness of how we're experiencing that in our own bodies. Okay, let me tell you a little bit about how active imagination and movement began. In the 1960s, Mary Whitehouse, who was a dance therapist in Los Angeles, began to feel that she wanted to work more directly with people. She was teaching dance technique, and she began to shift more into creative movement, and from there she was in her own Jungian analysis, to use movement as a way of helping people access their unconscious. And she trained, and she did some work in Zurich. She never became an analyst. And many analysts in L.A., though, did refer patients to her, and she did work with many analysts there, too. And she called her approach movement in depth to try to distinguish it from more traditional dance experiences. And her idea was based on active imagination, in which the intention is to allow oneself to be directed from within and to give form through the movement to images and feelings which came from attending to one's inner somatic experience. And her main point to people was to learn to wait for the impulse to move, to wait until you felt moved from within rather than ego-directed movement where you would act and move something out. She called that monkey chatter or making talk. She said you can feel the moment when your attention shifts and drops down and the movement arises from a deep inner place. And she called this authentic movement to distinguish it from more directed planned movement. And to support this, she tried very hard to create a space of quiet inner focusing and to really encourage people to stay with what came from inside them. So people were encouraged to keep their eyes closed and not watch what other people were doing, to really attend to what was moving them. And a couple of people, I mean, many people work with her, but a few that have had a big influence on movement today. One is Janet Adler. I don't know if, who moved here from, she's in Sebastopol now, moved here from the East. And she really developed authentic movement with particular attention to the role of the witness and the mover. Meaning there's a dyad. She was not doing analysis, she was doing movement. And one person moves for, say, an hour, 45 minutes or an hour, and one person is a silent witness. And the idea is to just sit and to focus in quietly and to stay with and experience and be with what's happening with the person who's moving. And then they meet and process the experience. And her work has since gone into a more mystical direction, and she's using it more as a spiritual practice now. Joan Chatterow is a Jungian analyst in San Francisco who also trained with Mary, and she's been instrumental in developing movement, particularly as a form of active imagination. And she has a book that was just published recently by Routledge called Dance Therapy and Depth Psychology, which would be a good reference. Unlike other forms of active imagination, which are typically practiced alone, movement usually happens in the presence of a witness. Although I think if you've done this work for a long time, you do develop an internal witness, but it seems to go to a deeper place when there's someone else to sit and hold that witnessing space. When I decide to introduce movement in an analytic session, I'm trying to deepen what's going on already, not to introduce an other thing. Partly because I think if you do that, it feels like the analyst is taking over the patient's experience. You know, now do this, now have this feeling. It would be opposite to what I would want. I try to use it when I feel that someone's struggling to articulate something that just doesn't have words at that moment, or they're very much in a feeling, and if we then start to talk about it, they're going to go up into their head and leave that feeling place. So I would typically say something simple, maybe let your eyes close, notice what you're experiencing in your body, any images or feelings that are there, and to just wait and to see if they want to develop into movement. And I have a large space, so there's people who've been working with me can get up off the couch, sit on the floor, go to the other end of the room, have a lot of space to move. And I feel like my job in those moments is to be quiet and attentive so that I can observe and be with the person in terms of what's emerging, rather than them having to interact with me about their experience. I generally, although I'm attending to images and feelings and my own associations, I would not bring them up at that point because I would think that that would be intrusive or taking over of their experience. I might note that, but I'm trying to really create a space for reverie in which what is felt can begin to emerge. And then later when we're talking, I might say, I noticed this or what about that, but definitely not when they're in the experience. Whether you're practicing authentic movement in a group or in a private practice situation, it's similar. The person can start from any position, sitting, standing, lying. You may ask them to focus inward on their breath, to let their eyes close. But that the main sort of thrust is to create a very quiet space. And if someone is new, I will probably say, let yourself wait. You know, don't rush the movement. See what's there. Notice your breath. I tend not to focus on amplifying a gesture or enacting an image, both of which have been used a lot in movement, because I feel that that somehow takes away. I'll talk about this later. Well, I'll just do it now. It'll be easier. What I'm trying in those moments is to create a potential space in which something can emerge rather than to direct the experience. So It can be helpful, for example, someone says, you amplify your gesture. Someone's doing a gesture. I feel this pain. What does it mean? I have a pain in my back. I'm carrying around all these burdens. You get somewhere, but you don't really get to what's underneath. So I tend to not go there. I think it circumvents a deeper exploration, and I think that I want to make more space to let the movement emerge from the unconscious. And particularly in the beginning stages, there's a lot of ego-directed movement. I just want to move, and I'll move this out. And I don't want to support that. I want to create enough quiet waiting space to see what comes from inside. Usually, in what I call ego-directed movement, the movement has very little affect. Whereas when someone's really moving from within, there's very focused attention and a sense of complete involvement. When I think about the focusing inward, the most parallel place I can describe it would be Winnicott's concept of transitional space or reverie, in which attention is given to that little space between the inner and the outer world where you can feel yourself being moved by something other, but there's still an observing ego. You haven't completely gotten lost, nor are you directly planning the movement. You have to be able to hold the tension of that in-between place. And when someone is focused on that place of reverie, Winnicott says that's the place that gives rise to fantasy and imagination. When you're observing the movement, you can see a kind of inner shifting. It's like a kinesthetic free association, where someone begins to move, and then that connects them to another image. And it's as though you watch the body make associations on a kinesthetic level. In terms of responding to the material that comes up, I would treat it like I would a dream, to pay attention to the person's associations, to notice how it may be connected to what's going on in inner or outer life. I really do not analyze the movement, and I think that's probably people need to know that in advance, because I don't think that's where it's at. I might notice and note and say something. When you began to sink towards the floor, there was a change, or when you pressed up against the wall. And I'll give you some examples later. But I it's really not about this movement means this. It's not at that level. I'm trying to make a space where the person's experience is primary rather than me analyzing it. And I think it's also important to say that it's not like a catharsis, like a big discharge. It really works when someone can hold the tension between experiencing the images and feeling the affect. The quiet, focused attention of the witness helps to create a containing environment in which the mover can experience a sense of being held and seen. Like Winnicott's mirroring or good enough mother, the witness tries to mirror and understand the somatic expressions of the mover. But rather than physically moving or physically mirroring the movement, the witness is trying to allow him or herself to be affected on a kinesthetic, a feeling, and an intuitive level. And also, as I said earlier, it uses any countertransference responses, images, associations, one's own bodily feelings to also gain a sense about what's going on. And then when the movement's completed, then we would sit and talk. And I also just wanted to distinguish between Mindell's work on dream body and Gendlin's work on focusing. I don't know if you're familiar with those. Gendlin, you know, talked a lot about focusing in on the Well, let's say Mindell and then go to... Mindell used... he talked about dream body and inner body sensations and connected fantasies, and he used enactment and dialogue as a way of amplifying, say, physical pain
or something that was going on in the body. Movement, authentic movement, is a little bit different in that there's less focus on the enactment portion and more on the waiting. So you might go there and see what's there, but rather than just amplify, wait, find different ways of moving, and let it grow. It has some similarity to focusing work in that there's the same emphasis on attending and feeling what's going on in the body, but again, this time the emphasis is more on movement. Oh, yeah. Okay. Totally silent. Unless, well, two examples when I wouldn't be. Unless I'm doing a group and we're focusing on some specific issues, maybe if I do a workshop on Anana or a workshop on childhood, and where I would be saying something during the movement, but it's said in a way that it's very open-ended. So it might be, imagine your mother's body at different times in her life. Notice what images keep coming back to you. Notice how she's holding herself. What does it feel like to try to be in that body? What feels familiar? What feels different? So I might say something like that, but it would be with a lot of space and time in between to associate to. When I'm working individually with someone, I tend to be quiet unless there's something going on where they need me, you know, they're saying something to me and then I'll respond. There's some really clear examples of that, so I don't want to leave them in a, you know. So then I would say something. Okay, accessing the somatic aspect of the unconscious. When people begin to focus their attention inward on internal and bodily felt experiences, one of the first things that seems to come up is material from the personal unconscious, particularly pre-verbal material in the form of affective or somatic memory. Christopher Bolas, in his book, The Shadow of the Object, suggested that somatic memory may be recovered when the patient is able to link affective experiences to a mental image. For example, when someone can't bear certain affects because they're felt to be too overwhelming, then the image and the affect are split to make something bearable. In this process, we get a lot of psychosomatic symptoms, anxiety states, such as depersonalization and disassociation. And when people began to focus inward on the body, what you see is defense mechanisms that begin to almost relax in front of your eyes. And as the unconscious material begins to emerge in the form of an image or a bodily feeling which has served to conserve the original experience. I'm going to have to give you an example, I think. I'm going to wait till in a few minutes there's an example, but it's the idea that you can't think about it. I had a person who, for a long time, when he would come, would say, "I have cancer. I have to go to the doctor." Now, of course, he didn't have cancer because he was going every week to the doctor to see if he had cancer. But what he felt was that the feelings that would come into him, he'd say, were beamed in from someplace else. They were so foreign to him because he expected himself to be a mind. He called himself the mind patient. He said, "I don't have feelings." I mean, he knew he had them, but he would said they come from another place. And so when he would start to go into his body, of course, all those feelings would rush up that he had been pushing away. So it was a slow and painful experience for him to get that these were his. You know, they weren't coming from someone else. They were really in him. Thanks.
Often in the process of recovering somatic memory, early childhood wounding and the defenses which develop to protect the person from infantile or primitive feelings are then re-experienced in the analytic relationship, and some of the most common are feelings of shame and guilt, envy, rage, annihilation, grandiosity, helplessness, grief, abandonment, and despair. When dealing with these manifestations of the unconscious, the patient can be helped by addressing the somatic component, which has been split off, and somehow focusing on specific bodily feelings which underlie these states of being seems to evoke a memory or other symbolic representation, such as a visual image, which can then be explored. So it's as though what was felt at a somatic level is now available to come to consciousness and to be thought about. Let me give you some examples. Both of these were patients who complained of recurrent bodily sensations in the session. And although this in the first example, this man was seen on the couch. I do see some of my practice on the couch. I don't know how people do that here. About a third of my practice, maybe, or half. There was a sense of him in a state of reverie. He was a man in his mid-40s who came because of a very difficult marital relationship. It was pretty non-sexual, they slept in separate bedrooms, they ate at different times, there were a lot of rules about how they could come together and not be together. And he was very lonely and isolated in his work. And he frequently complained that there was a heaviness in his chest when he would talk about his relationship with his mother. And he had no idea what it meant or why this feeling would suddenly overtake him. When I asked him to close his eyes and to sense his breath and just notice any images or bodily sensations, he was very surprised and said, "There's a big hand holding me down." And he said, "I don't have very much room to move," which was very parallel of his relationship with his mother. But whenever he tried to push the weight off, he said, I'm alone, I'm floating in a void. And he said to me, "I would be without anyone, I would be without a mother, and I would be on my own." And he began to make that connection that his difficulties with his wife were due to a sense of helplessness and paralysis about feeling that he could even live in the world as a separate person. And she would say to him, "How can I be sexual with you? You want a mother, and I can't mother you in such a concrete way." And yet he hadn't really dealt with the unmothered part because it was too terrifying to be floating in that void. Now, he was in reality floating in the void anyway. He just, he wasn't carrying that in his mind. As we explore these feelings in the analysis over the next several months, the weighted feeling would return, and he would work with the images and the bodily sensations. And as he became more able to hold his feelings of helplessness and vulnerability in his own mind in a more active way, that sense of being pinned down began to decrease. Now, in the next example, including the body, seemed to help this woman who was quite depersonalized. She came to treatment because she had a lot of body pains which had no physical cause. And one of her initial images while moving was of a soft, billowy foot holding her down. And as she worked to free herself, she felt very dizzy, but managed to succeed. And she had an image of being in front of a long hallway with a door at the end. And she said, "I'll never be able to make it to the door. I'll never be able to leave." Now, this despair was reminiscent of what she had experienced as a child, how hopeless her situation was at home. It was a pretty devastating home situation, and her need for her mother, that no matter how difficult their relationship, was very painful for her to acknowledge that she needed anyone. She was sort of that arch independence, "I don't need anyone," but of course the other side was she really did. As she began to be able to articulate her anxiety about her dependency on me and the fear that I wouldn't be able to take care of her, she would keep saying, I have a pain in my back, in my lower back. When I asked her to close her eyes and allow herself to focus on that area, she said, there's a black triangle, and I have this a lot. The image and the pain appeared every single time she began to move, and her feelings were a sense of anger and despair. As she moved with the image, she didn't have much image. She just said, there's nobody there, there's nothing there. There was an image of a baby in diapers, and she had the memory of her older sister babysitting her, and her parents left and, you know, went out for a while. But apparently she cried and she screamed and no one picked her up, and by the time the parents came home, you know, she had soiled her diapers, she was hysterical, and the other sister had just kind of left her. And I think this was a real memory, but it was also kind of a composite shadow memory of what it was like growing up in this family. As she was able to talk about the anger and the fear of that particular situation, as well as what she remembered in her particular family, the pain subsided. And in subsequent months, she moved, but that was not the predominant image. Sometimes authentic movement can help patients access feelings which are not yet conscious, but we would say they're known to the somatic aspect of the unconscious. And Joan Chattero suggested that certain memories are stored kinesthetically and are able to be retrieved through body movement, which I've also observed in clinical practice. Judith Matrani, she has a new book out, just came out a few months ago. It's called A Framework for the Imaginary, Clinical Explorations in Primitive States of Being. We just lost it. Hello? Judith Matrani looked at Daniel Stern's work in infant observation, and she had a model for the development of body memories. And she says that the earliest fantasies which are unrepresented mentally are recorded as body memories. Now, what she suggested was that it's the presence of a containing object which allows the infant to make sense of its nonverbal experience. So she's basically drawing on Stern's work of infant observation, but also Winnicott's concept of mirroring, in which the good enough mother is able to figure out and reflect back to the baby's experience. You're excited, you're tired, you're bored. Whatever's going on with the baby, the mother can interpret at a bodily level. So the infant has a sense, I'm seen, I'm taken in, I have a relationship to someone else, I have boundaries, I exist in relationship to an other, and their inner world begins to be articulated in the context of a relationship. Now, the other piece of this is that the infant is experiencing everything on a physical level. And often, as we know, we have experiences pre-verbally, and they're very powerful, but we don't have a way to communicate those because we didn't have language at that time. We had the experience. We may see a movie or a piece of art or have a dream in which we're back there, but we can't say, oh, the baby said this, the baby had that. It comes from a deeper place. One of the things that movement does, or that I try to make a place for, is to allow what's in the somatic unconscious to come out and be seen. And often there aren't initially words for those experiences, and that's all right. The idea is to make a space for that. Yes, I am. No, I'm not talking about the unconscious. I'm saying this is a level. Right. This is an aspect of the unconscious.
Can you give any other examples of the unconscious?
Of the somatic unconscious?
Well, yeah.
Oh, I hadn't thought about it. All right.
The way you framed it, or the way I
Well, I think we, you know, we talk about, if we're talking about, say, the personal unconscious, and we're talking about having a memory or a memory that was repressed, right, that's mentalized already. So what I'm trying to suggest
is really the distinction
is between mentalized and unmentalized.
Okay, and some others.
Right, and then when you go into the realm of what's unmentalized, how do we conserve that experience? I think we conserve it in the body. So, yeah. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Could you clarify the difference between, or maybe the difference is more I'm looking for, between somatic and kinetic?
How would you define kinetic? I mean, in terms of the unconscious? Or just, I mean, I think of kinetic in terms of being a dancer. Kinetic as moving, movement. Right? Is that what you... But that feels more ego. I mean, I can see I'm moving and I know what I did. The somatic unconscious would be... I can't yet tell you why I have this lonely, deep, scary feeling inside, but I know what it feels like.
Okay, I'm thinking of the different intelligences. And some people are
linguistic,
their intelligence is linguistic,
some mathematical, right. Kinesthetic. Then that would be kinesthetic.
So how would that relate to
somatic? Well, I think about that more like we talk about personality types, introverted, extroverted, sensation, you know, thinking, feeling, intuitive. That, or how we learn, some people learn visually, or people learn auditorily, people learn kinesthetically. It's a way of taking in information about the world. It's a way of processing information. So, I'm probably somebody who learns kinesthetically. You can tell me 10 times how to do it, but if I do it once, I always know, but if the other way, I won't. It's very frustrating. I'm married to a scientist who thinks he gave me a very logical explanation, and it's like, it doesn't really... help. Doesn't help me. So that's a way of processing information. So I could say, as an analyst, one of the things that's helpful to me is that I have a strong kinesthetic sense. And that helps me to feel into what my patient might be experiencing. And it's a way of making connection. I think that's different than the somatic unconscious. I can use my kinesthetic ability to help me understand that, but more what I found in training therapists to work this way is that what you have to really be able to understand and understand is your own primitive infant material.
Because
your own, one's own primitive infant material. So that if you're kind of harsh and judgmental and attacking towards those parts of oneself which are dependent and needy and terrified and, you know, if there's hostility and annihilating feelings towards our more primitive parts, we're not going to be able to tolerate that very well in our patients because we just don't want to go there. It makes us too uncomfortable. So part of what I emphasize when I'm training therapists is spending a lot of time there so that we can stand it. In fact, I've had this women's group for about 8 years, and we break into song a lot because sometimes it's just so incredibly painful. But you know that song, Chain, Chain, Chain? Well, everyone in the group was convinced it was Shame, Shame, Shame. So one day we did this whole dance together. We, shame, 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 shame on you. And then we acted out all those parts that we were feeling horrified about. Because there has to be a way of being able to stand feeling that. So I think that's the part of me that's trying to put the Jungian and the body together, is just rooting things in the body so it doesn't get up here. Just allowing oneself to have that. Let me give you another example. This is an example of looking at someone's emerging imagery and the affects that were underlying those, which he couldn't yet talk about. This is Robert. He was a single professional man in his 40s, and he came to therapy because he said, I have great difficulty forming intimate relationships. His mother was
enormously critical and unrelated, and actually recently someone said to him, "Your mother is the most self-absorbed person I know," and that was so helpful to him because it was reality. You know, it wasn't his fantasy. He was the person I described earlier who had the fear of cancer. Although he had a lot of insight and awareness, it was very difficult for him to let his feelings emerge, particularly in the initial stages of our work. He complained he felt numb. If any feelings were there, he said they came to him from outside. They were beamed in from outer space. I mean, he wasn't psychotic, but that was what it felt like. And the movement seemed to provide a transitional space in which he could begin to explore at an imaginal and somatic level the depth of his inner experiences. His initial image when he moved, and I treat the initial images like you treat an initial dream, what's going on, was of a giant mother figure whose body became larger. In fact, she was so large, she soon surpassed the room, and it was a larger room than this. Over a period of several weeks, the image of the mother began to shrink in size, and although she was still quite large, she was finally able to fit inside the room. I took this as a sign that Robert was beginning to feel more contained in our relationship. As he worked with the image of the mother, his sense was she was trying to get him to go inside of her body, which I thought it was his unconscious, incestuous, and infantile longings, which he was not wanting to think about, which turned out in this later was true. He circled around her. He said, "I'm very afraid of being swallowed up." And a woman appeared, which he said he thought was me. I thought, you know, could take the anima, take it as me, together. And we together went inside. I mean, I wasn't actually doing the movement, but this was his experience. And he literally went through this body. Over time, as our relationship developed in terms of the transference, and we were more able to explore his relationship with his mother, he more and more frequently began to, when I said this incorrectly, in the very beginning he went around the outside of her body. And the next several months he finally went inside. And to his surprise he said, "It's barren in here. It is a desert. There is nothing alive in here." And there were a lot of sexual issues also in this particular case, and just a lot of frozen up energy. And one of the things that happened was that, you know those the cactus that they have in Arizona? Yeah, with the big arms? It came over to him. It was like, and it wrapped its arms around him, and the spines went into his body, and he said, "It doesn't hurt." It's like something came inside. And one of the things that was very interesting to me was he was this brilliant math person, and he all of a sudden started studying biology. And he was fascinated. The mother's emptiness and depression, his feeling that if he had any needs, he would wreck and destroy whatever she had to give. And in terms of the transference at that time, there was a fear that if he were to show me his needs, he'd use me up or destroy me because I was like the mother. So he was very terrified. He'd let me see something and then he'd come late to the next session, then he'd show me another piece and then he'd come late. It was a very slow process of exposing all these pieces. When he said this about the cactus, my sense was this was a new kind of mother, a mother that he could take in but which was not wrecking him, which was not destroying him. It was a larger mother image, where he stayed intact, and if he wasn't wiped out, which were dominant issues in the transference at that time. As he struggled with his own unmet maternal needs, with the profound splitting which characterized his relationships with women, and with an awareness of his own aggressive impulses, he was able to take something of value from the archetypal mother, as well as to see his own mother more realistically. And his ability to hold the tension between his emerging images and the accompanying affects allowed him to use the movement as a means of symbolizing what had previously just been known somatically. Does that make sense? Okay. Let me just say a little bit about how we're doing, the development of symbolic expression. Because I know, as Jungians, we talk a lot about symbols and what symbols mean. But I'm particularly interested in how we come to symbolize and what supports the symbolic process and what inhibits it. And I know that one of the things that inhibits it is when we get very concrete. You know, we can't go into that imaginal realm. One of the people who wrote a lot about this was Hannah Siegel, who is a Pliny analyst. And she suggested that symbols govern the capacity to communicate, not only with others, but I think more importantly, with one's internal world. And they form the basis of verbal thinking. And whether in reference to overt behavior, the transference, or productions from the unconscious, dreams, active imagination, we're trying to understand the symbolic meaning and the affective dimension of the complex or the situation or the piece of analyzing. And several factors contribute to one's ability to symbolize and utilize symbolic expression. I think the first one, which we said earlier, is Winnicott's whole issue about transitional space and reverie. And if the infant really experiences a sense of being held, there's a relaxation. You know, it's like you're nursing the baby and the baby comes, and goes into that blissful state, and they're smiling and they're singing and they're beginning to hook up images and affects. Pleasure, breast, sucking, milk. You know, I mean, I just remember I was addicted to nursing because it was so fun. It was like you could watch this person go into a state of reverie and be in it with them. And in that space, in that transitional space, the infant is linking up experiences, linking up mental images, connecting them with the body, connecting them with the feeling. And that's what we're doing, really, in any kind of active imagination, is creating that quiet space of reverie. Winnicott suggested that when this relationship, maternal relationship, is compromised, such as impingement, a lot of fragmentation, somebody's not there, you know, somebody's nursing a baby, they're not there. There's a sense of, how do I say this? Things get very concrete. It's too scary to go to that imaginal place because it's not, the memory's not a pleasant one. There's a feeling of not being contained, things being fragmented. Not that quiet linking up space. In authentic movement, what we're trying to do is create a safe enough space so that that experience of reverie is primary. Now, Fordham talks about, in terms of infant development, this idea of deintegration and reintegration with the infant, the deintegrative, reintegrative. And Amara Sedoli has an article about that in the first 2 weeks of life. And but what it basically means is the infant, say the infant's asleep, but then the infant needs to take in a new experience. So it's waking up, it's deintegrating, which is very confusing because it sounds like disintegration, and isn't that? But you have to separate out and move so that you can nurse, or you can look at the mother, or you can relate to the other person who's there. And you take in the world for a while, and then you go back to sleep. That's the reintegrative process. When someone is in the state of, say the baby's crying, that's a deintegrative, things are coming apart. The baby's picked up and comforted, coming back together. It's a whole experience. If the baby's picked up, not picked up, and they're starting to deintegrate, at some point they're going to disintegrate. And that's when you have that feeling of no recovery, you know, coming apart and they're not going to come back together again. And that is one of the things that sometimes happens in movement, is you go to a place where, for whatever reason, in our own experience, we didn't get to get back together. And we really had to use our mind psyche to pull ourselves back together because there wasn't a safe way to get back together. One of my daughter's favorite stories is when my husband was 18 months, his family left with his older brother and sister to go across country, and they left him with a stranger babysitter, which she thought she couldn't imagine because she has this neurotic mother, you know, never leaves. So she said, well, what did you do? And he said, well, when they came back, I pretended I didn't know them. And I said, well, she said, well, why did you do that? And he said, well, I wanted to show them, you know, how big I was. And she said, well, you were really scared. He said, yeah, really, I was scared. But it's that idea of how do we create a safe space? And of course, when you go to movement, one of the things that happens is where we had those deintegrating, disintegrating moments, we do remember those. It's not the only thing that happens, but it certainly is there. When someone begins to do authentic movement, one of the things that I find quite fascinating is we can watch the symbolic process happening. So somebody who's in a very regressed state, their movement might look very fragmented, very disconnected. There's no developed sequence. They may have images, but they're kind of concrete and meager. There's not much underlying affect. The associations are quite minimal. For other people, you see intense affects, shame or grief or loneliness, and they might feel very overwhelming at first, but there's a sense of not so much catharsis as there is of feeling, learning to be connected to those feelings. For someone who's very intellectual, the movement might have like a quality of an acted story. I'm doing this, I'm doing this, I'm doing this, but the feeling isn't there. Over time, as that somatic free association begins to come, you can see a linking up between the image and the affective component. I want to give you a more extreme example of a patient who was extraordinarily fragmented. She was borderline with a definitely, she had a psychotic core. She had a particularly difficult childhood, a lot of death, a lot of violence. And she used movement to describe things which she really had no way of talking to me about without becoming extraordinarily fragmented. And I think it was a way that she really couldn't hold these feelings in her mind. And an authentic movement became a bridge by which she could communicate some of this. Initially, her movement had a quality of what I would call making movement, rather than waiting to allow herself to be moved. It was almost pantomime or gestural, and kind of a stilted and predetermined quality to the movement. And she would often, she talked to me while she was moving and tell me about her images, but I really had a very good sense just by watching her what was going on. Over time, as we worked in analysis to understand the feelings, memories, and associations evoked by her imagery, there was a gradual shift from making the movement towards allowing it to come in a more spontaneous way. But initially, she just had these very elaborate stories. Her growing capacity to tolerate the feelings and associations marked a development from a more paranoid schizoid, more concrete, to a more symbolic stance. And it took a long time before her movement became less concrete and more connected to what was going on from inside. She suffered, growing up, I would say, severe maternal and environmental deprivation. Her parents, both of her parents had been in concentration camps during the war. Most of all the family was, you know, gassed, was killed. She was the first child born after the war. She was named in honor of all the ones who had died. Family moved several times from country to country. There was a lot of poverty. There was a lot of, father was murdered. It was very severe. When she came, because she said she felt like she was anxious and depressed most of the time, she couldn't possess any man she was involved with. And she, whenever we tried to talk about the feeling, she would get very frantic and she would lie on the floor and scream. And I was seeing her in a clinic situation. It was very difficult because she was quite uncontained and she would hallucinate. And I felt like I had worked with psychotic patients, so she was, you know, that didn't get me so much, but it was just, she was so terrified. And I felt like I was with a terrified baby who had no skin, no sense of containment. And one of her themes that came up month after month was that she was a hateful monster, and she had claws which would destroy everything, including me. She reported chronic feelings of emptiness and a fear of being alone. Sometimes she literally moved as the monster. Later, she felt there were mommy and daddy monsters living inside of her, which she would attempt to pull out of her body in the course of a movement sequence. These she carefully placed in the monster pot, which was in the corner of my office, and she would put them there at the end of every session before she'd leave. She lifted up the lid, she said, my monsters are going in here, they're staying here until I see you again, I'm not taking them with me. And she acted this out over a number of months, first in movement and then in our relationship, you know, showing me her more monstrous parts. And I felt that she used the movement to show me what was going on in her inner world, and when she could trust that I could withstand the impact of these images, then she was more able to talk about her monstrous feelings towards me, her desire to destroy me, to get inside of me, to have my body for herself, and that the movement served as a safer way to begin to experience and acknowledge these more primitive infantile feelings. After, I think, about a year of working on this, Rachel said, "The monsters in the pot are cooked, and they are not harmful anymore." And I thought she was saying we had survived her destructive impulses, that, you know, that I had been able to survive her destructive baby part. Some months later, she used movement to tell me about a part of herself that she was just beginning to bring into our relationship. She said, "There is a creature in the corner of your office. It's angry, and it wants to be heard. It lives in the walls, and it's crying because it's lonely." Now, this came up in the movement, and she said, "Could you please come and sit closer? It's really ugly." So I moved closer to her, and she was still moving with her eyes closed. And I thought she was probably really scared of the anger and the grief, and she wanted to just have me nearby. And I sat quietly. And she was telling me this creature has claws. And what was different was that instead of becoming the image, she was interacting with it. So it was like there was a little bit of differentiation. I'm not it. It's a part of me. I can have a relationship to it. And she made a home for the creature with a bed, a stocked refrigerator, and a telephone that had my number and her number in case it got too lonely or scared. And in reality, she had been very unable to live at home, to cook for herself. I mean, she was in her 30s, but she couldn't cook for herself. She couldn't. She had about 6 boyfriends, and she just carried her diaphragm in her little bag, and she went from person to person to person. And I mean, she was very scared to be by herself. That changed over the years as we worked together. But it was just sexualizing her maternal needs. And I think as she got more of that met in our relationship, then the relationships with the men gradually consolidated. She called herself a little girl monster who was afraid to go out into the world. And she had the fantasy that by being such a bad girl, she could make everyone else good. And I asked her, did she mean her mother? And she said, yes. If I'm bad, then other people won't have to be. I do this with everyone except you. So the shift in our work was that she was slowly able to carry more of her good parts. Before, she felt so contaminated, she let everyone else carry them. She felt so contaminated internally that initially in our relationship, unconsciously, she assigned me to carry her healthy parts. When she had no hope for herself, she could feel that I did, and this would allow her to carry on. And I think her mother, who had lost so much of her family in the war, was really unprepared to meet the needs of an infant. And her earliest memories of her mother were crawling into her mother's lap and, you know, holding her face and trying to get her mother to look at her and patting her mother's face and, you know, "Mommy, I'm here, I'm here." And her mother was just in a daze. I mean, I think she was just so profoundly depressed. And unconsciously, if she could make herself the bad and worthless one, then she could preserve her mother as a good object. You know, she desperately needed that. And since her mother was, I think, barely there psychologically, it seems pretty likely that she couldn't tolerate Rachel's more infantile feelings. You know, and I think Rachel knew that intuitively, and she made herself the bad and worthless one because she needed a mother. This profound splitting, which characterized her relationship with others, and the recognition of it, allowed her to be able to more actively experience her anxiety and her fear of retaliation from the outer world as she gradually was revealing her bad parts to me. Now, in the initial stages when she was more regressed, the movement was, I said, very literal and concrete, like she was acting out a story. But when she let the movement be more connected to her feelings, then there was a shift. So initially more controlled, more gestural, she would interact with images who were doing things to her, but later on she could experience these as parts of herself that she had split off and projected out. So it's like the movement began to be a way that she could identify and link up parts of her own psyche. And initially, in our relationship, the transference was characterized by a lot of idealization, omnipotence, a lot of rage, a fear of annihilation, and that these images came up in her movement. But as she was able to experience a greater sense of cohesion, things really did change. She settled down to one relationship. She told me the first time she cooked herself a chicken, it was just such a big event. We went to the market, and I bought a chicken, and how do you cook a chicken? And just to be able to feed herself, literally. Let me just see if there's one little... Okay, it's 1/4 of, so should we take a little break and stretch, and then... Okay.
Very well done.
You already know all that because you live here, but I was... All right, we were finishing up with Rachel, who has so much unmetabolized affect. And for her, the imagery was a way that she could express and contain feelings that otherwise were much too fragmenting for her ego to bear. And initially, what she would do is tell me a story, I think I'm repeating myself, but a story about what was going on internally. And as she began to experience her feelings in relationship to me, her rage, her depression, her despair, her feeling of abandonment, then her movement shifted from stories to really much more of an expression of what was going on with her in that moment. So that was the, you could say, if you were being very Kleinian about it, that would be the shift from a more concrete paranoid schizoid position to a depressive position. She could feel bad about what happened. She could mourn in the loss. She could tolerate carrying those opposites. She could feel that in relationship to me. But that's where I find Klein's work useful, is how do we move from a concrete to a more symbolic state? We don't have to keep things split apart. We can hold those opposites. For people who have a more developed and flexible ego, imagery can serve as a creative and organizing function. And what seems to be critical is the person's ability to stay with the affective portion of what's going on, not just this elaborate story, but what's going on in the affective level. And the capacity, yeah. Okie doke.
You said that, like, I understood that, and all of a sudden realized when you put it in the way you did, it didn't really matter.
Okay, let's go back. What did you not understand? Let me think.
Fire for effect and receive that back.
Okay. When somebody's in a more regressed state of mind, they will tend to use the imagery in a more concrete way. This elaborate story is happening. They cannot yet feel the affects that are going on underneath. She can tell me there's monsters in the pot and they're doing this and they're doing that and they're crawling around, or there's devils and they're jumping and they're doing things to me, but she's cut off from the affect of it. It's a story to her. It's a long time before she can start to feel into what's underlying that story. So somebody who is more regressed, say even more psychotic, will come in and have fabulous imagery. I mean, I know that from working in psych hospitals. There's unbelievable imagery, but total disconnection to what that means for that person. You know, it's a story. It's not until you can get into the affective component of that and connect the image to the affect that you start to see more of an integration. Now, for somebody who has a much more developed ego, who's not at that psychotic end, say, of a borderline syndrome, then imagery looks totally different. It's creative. It's a way of organizing what's going on internally. But that's because the affects are present. They're there with the images. And when you see the movement, there's a connection. Somebody who's more schizoid, you may also see it's a story about this and this and this and this, but there's no feeling. So it's when they go together that there's a change, that there's something's happening. And so for people who are way in their head, you can use the imagery, but you don't think that that's the main event. Oh, the person's having fabulous images. It's like, so what? And everybody, he just turns on the channel, has the images. It's the important thing is that they're embodied. They're connected to what's going on at a feeling level, at an affective level. So it's not so interesting that somebody's just producing images. It's more what's the connection for them. And I don't mean emoting.
That's not where it is. It's more that it's not disembodied. And it's like you can come in and you have a dream, but you have no associations. You have this really elaborate dream. And I remember having that kind of an analysis where, well, it gets amplified and described, but I'm not there. You know, the person's gone off and done something else with the dream, but I'm kind of, well, I'm out of the picture. It's bringing those two parts together. Okay, So initially, so what I was talking about, Rachel, this capacity to deal with affective issues symbolically grows very slowly, particularly when there has not been somebody there to help metabolize and contain the feelings. So that's what was going on in the transference. I was serving that function, helping her contain and metabolize. Whenever we tried to deal with core issues verbally, she would, in the beginning of our work, she'd fragment, regress, scream. Often she'd hallucinate. And when we shifted to movement, she was able to articulate somatically what she couldn't yet communicate verbally. So the hallucinating and the screaming and all that would stop. This would be a focus. I'd say, show me with your body. Let your eyes close. What's going on in your body? And then something would begin to come. In the beginning, she usually showed me a story, kind of a movement story, and then we would kind of decipher the feelings and her associations and her memories to that. But over time, it was more a reflection of what the feeling state was. Now, the capacity to work symbolically, the expression of imagination, is often severely compromised in certain patients. And Fred Plaut, who's in London, suggests the capacity to imagine constructively is related to the capacity to trust. And I found this particularly true with working with people with borderline or severe narcissistic injuries where there's been a profound lack of mirroring. So there really isn't much trusting because that person was never really reflected back, contained on that core level. And those are people who tend to be more concrete rather than symbolic. It's like this. To go to that more symbolic world is very frightening. But as the relationship with the analyst becomes more internalized, that there's more object constancy, then such patients begin to move more towards the depressive position and have develop more of a capacity to work symbolically. But I think that really comes from the transference, in my experience, to that movement from the concrete to the more symbolic. And I'm bringing this in because some of my Jungian training, it was more about, well, some assumption, like we're all in the depressive position already and ready to work with all of our symbols. And I always feel like, but not me, I'm back here in some infant places. And my experience is that we go back and forth. You know, even if you think about, you know, Klein, who came out of Freud, she was trying to move from the drive theory to the position theory. But in my experience, we move back and forth. When we can't hold something because it's too painful, we get concrete. You know, we can just think about that in terms of our relationships. And it isn't very, it's very embarrassing. But I just try to say it's human and that it's a fluid experience and we try to be able to contain that depressive position but we can't always do that. So you see a parallel in authentic movement when a person's initial movement is to enact something more literal, like a mimed version of what's going on. They're acting it out in movement. And when the affect has been split off in this way, it's as though you see somebody making movements rather than allowing the underlying feelings and associations to emerge. Another example would be someone makes a repetitive gesture. And that's conserving more painful and often unconscious feelings of grief, despair, or abandonment. I have someone I saw for a long time who really, she had so much loss in her life, it was shocking. And I don't want to say more without giving more away. She had lived her life in a community, and the community, it was a nun, and there was a lot of loss within the community, and in terms of hope for the community and in a place for herself in the community.
and she had a lot of death in her life. And she really could not talk about it, but what she would do is this movement for hours. I mean, hours and hours and hours. And it was so, like, why? Why is this happening? How come it's like this? But it was just too much to, you know, in little bits and pieces she could begin to talk about it. And it was very painful for me as a witness because I felt like if she could cry, if she could really mourn that, then something would shift. But it was as though to let herself begin to mourn that, it at this point has not moved. Hopefully, as the relationship with the analyst can be experienced as a safe enough container, then these underlying feelings can be made available for analysis and begin to be integrated. And parallel with this process is a gradual emergence of a more fully embodied movement sequence in which previously split off affects and memories are present and in which the movement itself takes on a more symbolic quality rather than appearing mimed or cathartic. Another piece is that the affects that are released when people begin to do this work are not always easy to integrate. Particularly people who've had, I would call, borderline and narcissistic wounds. And I'm not saying narcissistic personality or borderline personality. I look at it more as wounds, profound, profound wounding in terms of being seen and taken in. Then there's often an acute sense of shame at a very core bodily level. And I think clinically such feelings suggest an overpermeable skin boundary and a failure in holding, meaning everything gets in. There's not a sense of, well, I can ward some things off, or my mother's going to be there to help me ward some things off. It's like too much gets in. And you can't really change that if that was your life experience. If your mother was depressed, I had a mother who was physically ill. When you have those experiences, it just comes in, and then you have to deal with it. And you can say later in life, well, it makes me more sensitive, it makes me more intuitive, but it also hurts a lot. And that failure in holding creates, so you have that sense of, I was telling Peter, my fantasy is to do a conference on psychic skin because I think it's very interesting how we get it, how we hold on to it, when we have holes in our psychic skin, you know, what contributes to the support of psychic skin. I think it's a big issue, so I just put that in to tell you it's something I'm curious about since I want to know. I'd like to know how you get it, how you hold on to it. The sense of shame is often acted out in the form of destructive impulses towards one's physical body. And I'm just thinking of a couple patients I had who were quite borderline, really severe, and, you know, did a lot of, like, burning themselves with cigarettes, self-cutting, mutilation, body piercing, and this feeling of, I'm doing that. In those moments, I can feel myself, you know, taking huge amounts of laxatives. In that moment of evacuation, I feel like I exist. Even though I'm evacuating everything, for a moment, that's the most alive part of my body. And I think this is the shame, but it's going in towards the destructive impulses towards the body. And there's a fear that if these feelings underlying the symptoms were to become known, they would overwhelm or annihilate the self. And the inner child or infants that struggle to bear so much unmetabolized affect in the body, and the ensuing splitting in an attempt to defend against this tension is constantly reenacted in the transference. Authentic movement may intensify this process in that the affects which have been defended against are now being experienced and expressed in the presence of the analyst. So it's like a double whammy. First you have to feel how crummy you feel, and then you have to feel how crummy you feel in front of someone else. And it isn't fun. It's very painful. And it's the ability to tolerate these painful states of mind. It's like growing psychic space, growing mental muscle to be able to hold on to these states of mind without disintegrating, which I think really contributes to the consolidation of the ego. That's how we get an ego. That's how we can stand to be here, is by being able to feel and stand all these parts of ourselves, particularly, you know, the shame, shame, shame parts that will do anything to not feel. In the process of naming and analyzing these painful states of mind within the containment of the transference, a relationship can begin to be formed to these abandoned and neglected parts of the self. They no longer have to be gotten rid of or relegated to the body, where they become mute, only able to communicate their pain somatically. Okay, let me say a little bit about witnessing. We said some things earlier that it replicates the mirroring relationship between the mother and the infant, in which the mother is able, through words and bodily responses, to communicate to the infant an understanding of its internal world at a bodily level. And while a large part of any analytic relationship is witnessing, in which we're trying to see and understand what's going on, it's heightened in movement because the person's aware of being seen at a nonverbal level. We're focusing on that for at least part of the time. And I think the ability of the witness to perceive the psyche as it is expressed via the body can have a profound healing effect, in that what may as not yet be conscious or able to be communicated verbally is seen and taken in and understood by another person. It's as though we want understanding in the places which we can't yet articulate. And we do this all the time in relationship, hoping that our partner is going to figure out this piece. And it's really devastating at times when that doesn't happen. I think this is particularly important when making contact with the more primitive parts of the self, because we don't often have words for those experiences. Often what first emerges is the person's response to being seen, and that the conflict between I want to be seen and I really don't want to be seen because you're not going to be interested, I'm going to be too boring, you don't really want to see this. And it's these hidden and encapsulated states of being. There's someone I love, she just died recently, Frances Tustin, and she wrote this incredible book called Autistic Barriers in Neurotic Patients. And I love this book so much, I took it out of the library in LA, I took it on vacation, and I got sand at Suntan Lotion. I mean, I didn't want to give it up, obviously, so I had to buy it. But she talks about how do you contact, in neurotic patients, people who are not psychotic, these encapsulated autistic-like states of being where there was no one there to reflect that. And so they've kind of been conserved, and they come out at really horribly painful moments. And being that I'm familiar with those places, I was interested in how we could, using movement to get to that, to make a safe place for those to come out. As the trust in the analytic relationship deepens, feelings which a patient can't hold on their own begin to come out. And I want to give you an example from Robert again, the man with the cactus. And I'm going to read it because I don't want to lose it. While lying on the couch, Robert was describing to me how frightening it was for him to be in the world, which he described as persecutory, sadistic, and cold. When I asked him to focus on these feelings in his body, he immediately went into a fantasy of leaving the earth and flying above everyone, feeling weightless but very powerful and in control. He reported this was a very familiar childhood feeling. He said to me, "I go into my head, above it all." This felt like a compensatory image to me, but rather than interpret it, I just asked him what it would be like to imagine himself living life on earth and relating to the people who were below. A noticeable heaviness seemed to descend over his body. He then stood up with his eyes still closed and began to move. I had the feeling of him commanding space, which was very new because he tended to kind of recede into the environment a bit, like he didn't belong. And in his imagination, he became very large, and he used his hands to scoop rivers and canyons out of the earth. And he alternately was creating and destroying the earth. He would say, "Here's a volcano, here's a mountain," and then he'd crash it all out. And he'd crumble it up in his hands. Then he'd carefully reform it again. He beat his chest. He said, "Like I'm King Kong." And he threw out his arms and hands, and he said, "I feel so powerful." And then he just stopped abruptly. Like, I thought, is there an image, an inner event? What's going on? While he was moving as King Kong, I had two very different responses as a witness. The first was a sense of joy and excitement about this expansion and power, which was very new. And the second image I had was of an angry boy who was destroying the mother world and reforming it to his own liking. I kind of felt like it was my body at times. And as I sat with these two contrasting images, I said, what's important is that he feels empowered and that he expands. But to myself, I was thinking, is this at the expense of some other part of himself, which he often kept hidden, both from himself and from me? When he stopped moving, I said, can you feel a boy inside of you? Because that was just, the image was so clear to me. And he said, yes. And he said, the boy is encased in ice. My arms are bound to my sides. He said, the boy's eyes are staring straight open. And I felt incredible sadness and despair. And he said, the boy will topple over if the ice is not there to support him and freeze him in place. And the recovery, as he called this ice boy, marked the emergence and recognition of an abandoned and frightened boy inside. As he began to rock the ice boy in his arms, a gradual empathy developed to this previously split-off part, and a mourning for what had been lost in childhood could begin to take place. In the months following this session, the unconscious responded with a number of dreams in which Robert journeyed north to meet an Eskimo boy who had things to teach him. Does that make sense, that example? And more recently, he's had dreams of his arms being reaching out but being frozen by grief. And he's been so angry in much of his life, angry with women for not meeting his needs, angry with colleagues, angry with me. What's been harder to get to is the grief of being so alone. And as that has begun to come forward, things have really begun to shift for him. In this example, his persecutory and coldly sadistic impulses had been split off and projected into the outer world, which was experienced as harsh and attacking. And initially it was difficult for him to hold these feelings in his mind, and this was reflected in his impulse to go above it all. This was followed by the fantasy of being King Kong, in which he was able to safely experience at a bodily level feelings of omnipotence, grandiosity, and aggression, all of which he felt had been really forbidden by his parents, but particularly his mother. Underlying the image of King Kong was the somatic memory of a boy who had to ice over both his destructive and creative feelings, which were experienced as being too overwhelming for his environment to bear. Robert was left with a sense of having some terrible secret. With no way to think about his aggression and destructive feelings as being a part of himself, they had to be split off and projected out, with the result that they could then come at him at any time, making the outer world an often frightening and unpredictable place. Similarly, his envy of others' creative accomplishments, coupled with a secret grandiosity that nothing he could do would be enough, left him with a sense of despair about his own value. This movement sequence paved the way for an exploration of his creative and destructive aspects of his aggression and provided an arena in which he could begin to gather these parts of himself together in the context of our relationship. And he realized a fear that if he expanded, he was going to hurt his mother as well as me. That was his fantasy. And I think it was the process of having to ward off his mother's rather continuous envious attacks, coupled with the experience that no one was there to help him bear his excitement and overstimulation, that had left him frozen. See with me? I mean, he had a mother who would say things to him like, you're never going to be tall enough to be president. But what, it was like come out of the blue. You know, he wasn't even thinking about being president, but it was kind of continuous, you're never going to be enough, you're never going to be enough. So this was somebody who's enormously brilliant but couldn't get a PhD because he felt he had to get three. I mean, he had to, so that he could just be so superb. And when he tried to, he's extremely creative and artistically gifted, but that there's a feeling that he doesn't have a space to bear all the excitement of the stimulation of that. There's a wonderful article in JAP about this. Peer Hultberg. Let me just give you the reference, because I think it's one of the best. It's called Success, Retreat, and Panic, Overstimulation and the Depressive Defense. Basically, you have good things happen, but you don't have a place to take them in. So the whole person, you sort of go into the state of disintegration, because that's easier than bearing the excitement of the good experience. He made the connection between his fear of overstimulation and his hesitancy to engage in sexual relationships with women. The fear of being out of control at a bodily level was very scary and left him feeling vulnerable and exposed. As King Kong, he experienced both his aggression and his secret sense of omnipotence, as well as the fantasy of having no limits. As this secret grandiosity became more exposed, first in the movement and then in terms of the transference, he began to develop a more realistic view of himself. He realized that his secret omnipotence had protected him both from his own feelings of helplessness and dependency. And being able to bear his feelings of being small also allowed him to begin to tolerate a greater sense of expansion. And this became evident in the ensuing months. He was someone who only ate at restaurants, and one of the things that happened was he was low on money, and he was thinking, well, I'll cut down on my analysis, but all this was happening. So I thought, wow, yeah, is there another plan? And he said, well, you know, he could cook. He had never cooked, because he was afraid that the food, you know, he would wreck the food, he would poison himself, it would spoil, that something would be wrong, because he felt so contaminated. But as we began to talk about this, you know, he started to try it, and now he's like this gourmet cook. And this is somebody who, when I met him for years, never ate at home, never lived at home. And so he's really made his apartment beautiful and decorated. And the other thing that's happened is that he's begun to develop really relationships with colleagues at work. And this, because the issue of envy and competition was so profound, I think from his mother and from his own feeling of being inadequate, coupled with needing to be so grandiose, he was just very sort of schizoid and separate. And what began to change was dealing with his envy in a very open way towards the other men that he was working with. That one's smarter than me, that one's better than me at this. And how horrible it was to feel envious, but also how relieving to have it able to be talked about. I think that as a witness, authentic movement and witnessing, from the witnessing side, is very helpful. I said this earlier, in terms of developing one's understanding of the somatic aspect of the countertransference. And particularly since the person's not speaking, you have to attend to mood, to gesture, to your intuition, you know, to what you're feeling in your body. And even though you're sitting very quietly, you're really trying to reflect as much as you can on what's stirred up in you in response to watching the other person, and to clarify and differentiate what does that stir up in me? What is that for them? What is that evoking in me? What is that for them? You need to have this split attention. It's like a quiet listening and a split attention. Now, I just wanted to say a couple things about the witness. I said this earlier, that if you have a punitive and harsh attacking attitude towards your own inner infant material, it makes it very difficult to tolerate that. And so movement, because it allows you to go back inside that place, does make it easier to kind of hold that in your body. All right, let me just say one other piece about witnessing here. In terms of the mother-child relationship, if the mother is so merged with the child that she cannot mirror the baby, then often what the baby is left with is an experience that part of itself resides.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU and Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.